Hello, everybody. Just a very quick one about Instagram. If you're on it, Meta, the parent company, is reducing the number of political posts visible to users on their feed. This is a real thing, not a hoax. So go to your Instagram profile, tap the three horizontal lines in the top right corner to open the settings tab, scroll down to what you see, click on content preferences, open political content, and turn on don't limit political content. That's an option. Otherwise, you won't see almost anything we post because we are deemed political. Please do that now, or you won't even see the posts about our shows, our fun things. So if you want to see Guilty Feminist content and know when we're coming to a place near you or releasing a new podcast, do it now.
This episode of The Guilty Feminist is brought to you by British Airways.
I'm a feminist, but I've always secretly liked those pictures of what they call cheesecake women on the side of Second World War aeroplanes. Where it was like someone to send the boys off and they'd have like a picture of a woman in a bikini or a leotard or something who was very curvaceous, very Marilyn Monroe type on the side of the plane. And of course, I don't admit that to anyone. Of course, I'm not going to be like, oh, I love it. You know, because it's not, these women were not like empowered women, you know, commodifying their bodies. This was like an illustration that was completely male gaze, drawn by a man, looked at by men, made to reframe women. I went to an estate sale. Last time I was working in LA on a screenplay, so I got to go to Hollywood. And in Hollywood, they have these amazing estate sales. And I don't know if everyone knows what that is, but it's like when someone passes away and then the family take what they want and then they go, look, we, you know, there's a lot of beautiful stuff here, but we can't obviously take it all into our house. So we're going to just, people come into the house and buy it. And in Hollywood, these are old Hollywood legends.
Yeah.
And it was like an old Hollywood screenwriter that I admired very much. Wrote one of my favorite films. I went to lunch in the day and it was a film producer who I was working for was like, we're going to have some martinis. Now, I'm not a big drinker, Sarah. I'll have one vodka and soda on a Friday. But, you know, I want to be convivial.
You're in LA. You have to do the thing.
I want to seem like I'm, you know, cool. And like, you sure. And I want this guy to like me and, you know, work with me. And also, I love a martini. It's just I would very rarely have one. And certainly not in the day. The first one was so strong, it emboldened me to think I wanted a second.
Okay.
So I was the one that said, let's have a second drink. He was just having like a brunchy, fun, let's have a day off feel.
Deborah, this is not something you can handle in the daytime.
Something about these cocktails. I understand why other people like to drink based exclusively off this experience. This is, I guess, how other people feel when they drink all the time. I've never was like, why do you want to feel sick and sleepy? No, I felt like I guess other people feel when they drink. So I had this second martini and I felt like $1 million and I could take on the world. He was like, okay, I've got to go off. I've got another in a series of fabulous meetings or something. And I thought, oh, this estate sale is on and I really wanted to go. So obviously I couldn't drive in the situation. I jumped in an Uber because it was very nearby and I went in and I was as smashed as Don Draper is by 11 o'clock in Mad Men. Went into the estate sale, feeling like $1 million. And like, oh my God, like I'm working in Hollywood. This is a dream come true. But I saw this cheesecake picture of a woman like on the side of a plane from exactly this era. And I was like, well, I must have this. And then I realized it was a set of five.
Oh God.
And I thought, well, I must have them. And of course, they're very cheap because it's an estate sale and they're just trying to sell it off. I accidentally bought five, and I think it's fair to say unfeminist pictures. What am I going to do with them? Where can I hang them? Who can I give them to? I still have them on top of a wardrobe and I've never admitted it to anyone. Five increasingly sexist pictures, which I just thought, well, of course I need these. You know, when I went home and I thought about that when I woke up and I thought, deep down inside of you, there is an unfeminist piece of you that has been trained in childhood to see certain things as sexy. There's a piece of the male gaze inside of you who only comes out after two Californian martinis that must be monitored. And that Is my side of the plane relevant? I'm a feminist, but. Sarah Barron, do you have an I'm a feminist, but?
Do I ever? And it's possible it's darker than that one, so you've got to support me in the vulnerability here, Deborah. I am a feminist, but I think I can count on two hands the number of flights that I've booked for myself.
Oh, my God. Sorry. I mean, that's fine.
You're going to support me.
Sorry, supportive.
You're going to support me in that because I thought it's travel related. It's very plane focused. And in fact, in a lot of ways, it's very British Airways focused. And it is my dark truth. And I am sharing that for the podcast. Now, it started with my mother. My mother is a hyper traveler. So all through childhood and then even into my sort of early adulthood, she'd say, what if you and I went here together? And I'd say, that sounds nice. Then I wound up with some friends who were hyper travelers and they did all the bookings because somehow I would mess up the admin. But then, and you see where this is going.
Did you marry a man?
I married a man.
Some kind of trad wife, patriarchal.
It's possible that those are the life structure? Choices that I've made.
Oh,
and
my God.
Books
all the flights. Now, why is that? Is it just, I'm going to interrogate this a little bit further.
Okay, just be gentle with me because this is a very, very shameful secret. Go gently into this dark night.
Okay, just, is it one of those relationships where one of you's good at admin, you do the admin, one of you's good at other stuff, you do the other stuff, and you just play to your strengths, and it doesn't particularly fall down gendered lines at every turn? Or is it just, he likes booking the flights, or is it like, oh, I don't really know how to do that. I don't want to mess it up. Which one of those is it?
Okay, so if he does it, I do know how to do it, and I have booked some flights.
Two, you said.
No, I said I could count on two hands. I bet I booked 10. Maybe I even said that for comic effect. Maybe I've booked 13. I don't know. But the point is, it's a small number.
Yeah.
I know how to do it.
Yes.
But he will find the deal.
Oh.
He will have his head around a logistic that I will somehow ignore. And so then maybe what that means is on those occasions when I book it or it's like some, you know, some work travel for me or something like that where I'm going to do it, I will say, am I missing something? Does this look right to you? And does this seem like an appropriate price? And those do not feel like
because you're
questions.
Like one of those politicians that doesn't know the price of a pint of milk.
Yes.
Okay. I'm going to make a counter confession.
Okay.
I'm a feminist, but I also rarely book a flight, but Airbnbs and hotels, all mine, baby. And I'll tell you why. I will search and search for budget luxury. If I know I can only spend this, I will look and look and look till I find something I really, somewhere I really want to stay for that price. And I'll hold out and I'll hold out. And I look at hotels, I look at Airbnbs, and I just obsess about it until I find somewhere I really want to be. So I do all the accommodation always, and he does the flight. So I think that's an and because we're dividing labor as best our skill sets.
I respect your choices and support them.
Excellent. Hello and welcome to a very special episode of The Guilty Feminist, brought to you by British Airways. Travel plays a big part in my life, I have to say, and I know the same will be true for many of you who are listening as well. So what we want to do with this episode is celebrate the power of travel to impact us as people. For most of us, it's not just a case of getting from A to B. We genuinely love travel because it exposes us to new cultures, new experiences, and meeting new people. Things happen when we travel, which can set us on a new path in our careers or our personal lives. Sometimes we meet friends, lovers, long-term life partners, or we meet ourselves head-on somewhere we don't expect to be. We'll be diving into all of this and more. So for this episode, I thought it was only right to invite back a friend of The Guilty Feminist who has had many of the same travel experiences and perspectives as me. Or has she? We're about to find out. Sarah Barron, thank you so much for joining me.
Deborah, thank you for having me back.
It is always an unqualified delight. You're one of my favourite people to talk to and listen to on podcasts. How would you say that travel has played into your life?
I know that no good sentence starts with the phrase, as an American. But I'm going to have to begin it this way. As an American, what I think has been really interesting is living abroad. You really need to live abroad as an American to understand you're not the center of the universe. Mm. It's really hard to take on board that people don't think about us quite as much as we think about us. Mm-hmm. And I have really enjoyed understanding my global place in that way a little bit better. And also I feel, you know, I miss things about the States all the time, but I also have been exposed now to environments where healthcare and education is provided for you. Mm. And that has been a very interesting experience.
As an Australian,
of course,
who left home and, you know, we're both from other countries and live here. We both married Englishmen.
Yes, we did.
We did.
Why? Why have we done this?
I'm really pleased with my choice.
That's sweet for you.
Yeah. Your Jeff is just a wonderful man.
I'm pleased with my choice as well. But what's funny to me is that, like, Americans are so, you know, the Brits generally don't delight in an American. The Americans delight
in a Brit.
In a Brit. But I
have think we've married 4 weddings and a funeral. That's what we
essentially
think.
That's why we made our choices. But do you not, have you gone on a journey with yourself where, like, before I knew my husband, I was like, oh my God, an English accent. And now after being with someone for 13 years.
Oh, sure, that's one off.
That's really the magic has drifted away.
Oh, of course, of course. If that's part of the appeal, when you meet an Englishman, then please be aware you will get used to it.
And
then
you'll fade.
And then you'll also have to be used to everything else they are. So choose wisely, gang. Don't be blinded by the accent. Be turned on, but do not be blinded. As an Australian, what's interesting, it's the opposite of what you've just said.
Oh.
Australians often feel we're very far away. Nobody thinks about us at all. Mm-hmm. And we don't have a central place in the cultural conversation. And I think there's a little bit of a national feeling that abroad is better or more jazzy and fizzy or whatever. And I will say, having lived in London for a long time and a couple of other places, every time I go home, I am a little bit more singing in my heart.
Oh.
I still call Australia home because I go back and I realize what a wonderful place it is in many ways, how beautiful it is, how naturally beautiful it is, how wonderful the lifestyle is. At the moment, they have a left-wing government, which I personally find, you know, when I go back and I see some of the policies are being enacted, I mean, it's never, you know, progress enough, but it's anything going in the right direction, given the rest of the world at the moment, feels
good,
like a good thing. And so I think I feel, every time I go back, Australia feels more central, more buzzy, more on the world stage. Huh. And I love going back with the Guilty Feminist because, actually, I'm going back on tour in May with the Guilty Feminist to Australia and New Zealand, or Aotearoa. And I have to say, I love it. I love the audience. I love the feminism. I love the response. And it makes me proud. Feel engaged, and there's a homely part of me that's really engaged. Is it true for you, as it is for me, that the decision to live abroad means you are a traveler for life because you have to go home? You can't just go, oh, we won't travel for a few years. And I know there are environmental issues with that sometimes that make me think, oh, but it sort of forces you not to get too comfortable where you are, almost like it forces you to reconnect and rethink every now and again. Do you feel that about, because where are your family?
My family's in Chicago, but so much of my life was in New York. But, you know, it's just a general sense of chapters in other places.
Yes.
And I think, like, and any good question, there's a yes and a no to that. You know, are you a perpetual traveler if you live abroad? Because I think if you're not really careful, I don't know if you found this, but it sucks the travel impulse out of you, potentially, because every time you travel, it's like, I got to go see family. I should see family. We should get to the States. Let's go to Chicago or we'll go to New York. We'll go to Chicago or we'll go to New York.
Or both while you're over there.
Or both while we're over there. And then there's less bigger exploration that goes on.
Mm.
But I also, again, I just think that the more I think, like, my mother travels all the time. That's her. She's retired now. That's how she likes to spend her money. But she has always lived in the same small town right outside of Chicago.
Right.
And it's interesting, like, sort of what she understands about the world because she travels all the time versus what do I understand about the world because I live abroad and travel for work. And then sort of see this country a lot because of work travel. So you have to put some effort into it, don't you think? You have to sort of
decide to go somewhere just to explore and find a new side of yourself, as opposed to, like, I've got a rush home. I've got a week here or 2 weeks there, a month there. I've got to go. And I've been lucky with the Guilty Feminist that I don't just go home and see my family. I visit all of these different places. I've found I have biological family who are now my family, because I've known them for over 10 years now, in New Zealand. And that trip, actually, which I did with British Airways, to meet the biological family for the first time, I'd spoken to them on the phone, but I don't think we'd Zoomed because it was before we really did that. Like, I guess we could have Skyped, but it wasn't really the culture, you know, to Skype or FaceTime or anything like that. It was like 2013.
I think this is a little, we end met in 2016, and I think you had somewhat recently met them.
So end of 2012, beginning of 2013, I did it. And so it was January 2013 that I got on a plane and I said, in fact, I was doing a sort of live documentary style show as I was going, like a live storytelling comedy show, but also, you know, poignant, very poignant at parts.
Oh my God.
A show where the audience would cry about finding my biological family as a way to sort of documented therapeutically. And I remember saying to the audience, tomorrow I get on the plane to go to New Zealand and you are the last audience to whom I will ever say I have never met anyone biologically related to me. And I flew into Brisbane first because I needed 24 hours to just get over my jet lag, get a blow dry. Remember that? I want to look good for the first time.
You got to show them those good jeans, don't you?
Yeah, exactly. I just wanted to, you know, didn't want to get off like sweaty and in pajamas and, you know, have a little zhuzh, I thought. Sure. Have a little zhuzh. And then I had to fly Brisbane to Auckland and I'll never forget that flight. That was, I had to, do you know what? Great thing about in-flight entertainment, I had to disassociate. I remember I watched like Pitch Perfect.
Fabulous. Not as good as Pitch Perfect 2, but still good.
It might have been Pitch Perfect 2, actually, but it was like something where I can just totally, I cannot face what I'm doing.
Why? Yeah, why did you need to disassociate?
Because you're going to meet your DNA. And I'd never even seen a picture of anyone related to me until 4 weeks before or whatever. Happened all very quickly. And I just couldn't. My whole life, I'd never connected with anyone and seen my genes, you know, in anyone. And the fact that we live in an age where you can, you know, 24 hours, you can go and meet your whole DNA heritage, even though they're in a different hemisphere, is extraordinary. And it really filled in a piece of the puzzle with me. But I remember them at the airport so well. I remember my friend dropped me at the airport and then my birth mother and sister and niece came to the airport and they were all like so excited standing there like, and it was so weird to walk towards people who look like me. Like I look exactly like my birth mother. She looks like me a generation older. And I knew exactly who she was, of course, you know, and I just walked towards her and we hugged at the airport. And I remember it was a bit of an awkward hug because she'd never held me.
Deborah.
She'd never held me. I got taken away. She had to give birth behind a sheet. She never got to see me. She never got to hold me. So we'd never held each other. And the first hug, of course, is so you want it to go so well. It's just a bit awkward. And then we got in this car and we went back to my sister's place and she put out cheese and wine and everything. And we started to get to know each other. And then over, I stayed for 2 weeks. And of course, in that time, then there were tears and hugs and, you know, greater connection grew, photos shared, memories shared, similarities in gesture, similarities in weird things. We played a guessing game with the kids and Devon and I kept guessing the same thing at the same time and things like that. Devon's the name of my birth mother. And I remember that being such a, actually, I remember the flight so well. I remember getting on the plane going, this is the flight towards your past and your future at the same time.
What has that relationship looked like across the last decade?
I usually see them once or twice a year. Because I go back to New Zealand, you know, whenever I go to Australia, I pop to New Zealand, I see them and I spend time with them. But also they've come over, you know, various ones have come over. The next travel story from that experience was I was having IVF at the time and I needed a donor egg because my eggs didn't understand the assignment. Let's put it that way. And my sister Mel, like on the first night I was there and we were like
a biological sister.
My biological sister Mel, half sister Mel. My biological sisters all have kids and they were saying, you know, would you like to have a kid? And I said, are you going to have any babies? And I said, well, actually, I'm doing IVF at the moment. I said, I'm getting a donor egg. And she went, I'll give you an egg. I'll give you an egg. And I said, oh, no, no, no. Like, I'm not here for an egg and a kidney. You know, like, I was like, oh, my God. And anyway, she absolutely insisted. And she said, no, I've always wanted to do that. And so the next connection we ever had was a few months later, she got on a plane to London. She'd never been to London before. She'd had a baby really young. And so she'd always wanted to travel. But, you know, she was raising kids. She lived in a, you know, the New Zealand, beautiful little New Zealand beach town she'd grown up in. But she'd never had that big explore. But she's very like me in nature.
Uh-huh.
And so it was an extraordinary time because this is, we'd only known each other for two, you know, we'd been 2 weeks in each other's company. So it was the most extraordinary week of tourist attractions and invasive medical procedures. So in the morning, we'd both be up with our feet in stirrups with speculums up us. In the afternoon, man, we'd go to the Tower of London.
Wow.
Then to Rock of Ages. I took her to Paris and we couldn't walk down the street. She would stop to take pictures every 3 feet. She was so excited to be there. I remember taking Mel to the airport and I wrote her this card, which I smuggled into her hand luggage so that she would read it on the plane, in which I said, we took biology on and lost, but really we won because it made us sisters. Now I'm like crying. You've been crying for ages, Sarah. This is pathetic. But I remember that so well. And I feel like that's when we became sisters and I really became an auntie to her daughters. And I actually took my three nieces, who are now all gap year age, you know, I took them to Tokyo last year because it's equidistant between Auckland and London. And I speak some Japanese because at school I learned Japanese in Australia and then I worked as a concierge. So my conversational Japanese is
the gift that keeps on giving. Also, I have to blow my nose after this story. It's been too much. Please excuse me.
It was a big deal because I wanted to be like, I want to take you on one big trip and sort of open that door to the idea that there's a big wide world out there and you can live it. And I planned that trip within an inch of its life, consulting it with them. Like, do you want to do this cultural experience? Do you want to do it? I let them all choose a day. And we did all this cultural stuff and all this really cool Tokyo stuff and art exhibitions. And then 2 days in Tokyo Disney, which was honestly, they adored everything. And I think it did open their mind, but nothing beat Tokyo Disney. They were like, we're at Disneyland. Because often if you're from Australia or New Zealand, that seems so far away in a way that it doesn't if you're from America or Europe.
Okay.
And they flipped out for it. So that was, what a joy. 10 years, it was 10 years, almost to the month that I met them. I got them to take them. I got to take those kids who I've been in their childhood. You know, I've been 10 years in their childhood. They've known me. They've grown up with me. I got the blessing of three nieces, and the big gift I wanted to give them was not money, it was travel. It was not education, it was travel.
It was the gift of experience and understanding the wideness of the world.
And a culture that they wouldn't otherwise experience, and an open door to a language, an open door to different foods, different experiences, and Disney. And the mouse. Sarah, what experience in your life stands out that when you left the airport, you were one person and when you came back to the airport, you're a different person?
So I would say that more broadly, the journeys, the internal journeys I have been on and my actual outward physical journeys is before and after motherhood, I think. Because I am not quite a natural traveler. I get anxious, I get worried, but after I had a kid, traveling without my kid became a moment of such impossible luxury that something shifted in my brain. So a flight wasn't, oh, all right, we got to do this flight. We've got to. It became windows of time that I was on my own, and I would have a glass of wine or a glass of water that someone had brought me, or a little bag of pretzels, and I would watch films and read my book. And I think also in the world today, being on an airplane is such, if you don't buy the Wi-Fi, is such a fabulous, tiny, singular pocket in which you can only read your book or only watch the
100%.
Film.
I used to love it when there was no Wi-Fi.
Oh, it's because fabulous.
Nobody could demand an email from
no.
you. Now sometimes I think, oh, maybe I should just
no.
buy it.
Don't do it. Don't do it. Resist. Have that little pocket around you when you are protected. And I really, now even, you know, my son is older now and traveling with him is a much more manageable thing, but I still do a decent amount of travel without him. And it really helped me think of the journey there and back as part of the experience, as part of what is fabulous. You're still not at home. You're in the sky. For God's sake.
Oh, it's insane.
You are in the sky.
It's wild.
How dare you treat this like anything other than a magical experience?
I absolutely agree with that. I am so lucky I'm not a nervous flyer. So often I'll get into a book or switch a movie on or something like that. And I will not even notice we've taken off. That's how not a nervous flyer I am. Uh-huh. I'll look out the window and go, oh, we're in the air. Do you know what it is for me? It's clouds. When we're in the clouds, I'm like, oh my God, this is against God and nature, obviously, but yes. It's a miracle. And you just think, how is this possible?
I flew to your native Australia once. I've only been once. And I'm not the best sleeper on an airplane. And I've never traveled to that section of the globe ever. And there was some point where we were over Saudi Arabia. I was like, that is Saudi Arabia down there. That is Saudi Arabia. And it was like the first time I understood the curvature of the earth, if you know what I mean.
I know what you mean.
And you're like, we're all alone in the universe. I was able, because I come in over the East Coast of America all the time. I come in over the coast of Ireland all the time. You know, they're Greenland. There are these points that I'm used to seeing in an airplane that I had never seen. The Middle East. And that made me, you know, when I was talking before about when your home is abroad, you have to be very careful about keeping the travel bug alive, because otherwise you can just go back and forth. Like, it reminded me that I want to be someone who sees a bunch of stuff at some point. Mm-hmm. And I'm not young anymore. So I don't, I'm extremely young, but I don't know quite when that chapter is coming for me. But it's coming. I want to be one of these people whose body hits every continent.
I think that's a lovely goal, because you don't want to be in your deathbed thinking, I never got to go to that Moroccan market, or that, you know, I never got to see the Great Wall of China, or whatever it is that you have that you... And I don't think it's about ticking things off. I hate it when people say bucket list, because I'm like, what? It's just like going around ticking it off. And I've traveled with people when I was younger that were... like, we've got to go everywhere and get a fridge magnet so that everyone knows. And literally they said, so everyone knows where we've been. And sure. I was just like, no one cares where you've been.
No.
Where you go is for you. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, and increasingly that's probably a little different now that people have social media and they like to post about it. But honestly, I've quit a lot of that. I'm just like, why am I sort of bragging to people, hey, I'm here in, you know, California or whatever. I'm like, no, I'm here for me. I'm looking at something. I'm being here. And no one else cares. Or if they do, they're just like, oh, I'm sad. I'm not in that lovely sunny place. So I've really changed how I view all of that. Because when it was a novelty, it was like exciting. Oh, I can share this like a postcard with everyone. And now I'm like, I like to be places privately where I'm just seeing who I am in that space, or seeing what that place is that makes me question my assumptions.
Where have you traveled to where you've seen the most beautiful vista? I love beautiful.
Lake Louise in Calgary.
Really? That's the one.
It really stands out to me. I was young. I hadn't traveled as much. We went rowing on the lake, and I was in a beautiful long dress.
Oh.
And I felt like I was out of a
You're Heidi. You're Heidi.
Yeah. I felt like I was out of a book or a painting. And it was just remarkable. It feels like you're in some kind of almost simulation. It's so beautiful. to be on the lake. What about you?
One was I went to the south of France where I'd never been before. And, it, you know, again, as an American, you know, France, Americans were obsessed with everything European and probably most especially France. And so getting to go to the south of France and seeing the Côte d'Azur is like unbelievable. And I was on, you know, an incredible sun lounger with rocks and then water and then some, you know, oligarchs. Probably French house over here. And then in the distance, you know, these incredible bridges. And it was, that was amazing. And then also on my honeymoon, my husband and I went to Martha's Vineyard. At this Airbnb we rented, there was a hammock alongside a lake.
Beautiful.
And it was autumn, but it was warm. And I just remember looking out onto this lake, sat in a hammock with my new husband and all the New England autumn. And I thought, this is very special.
Yeah.
I know you'll remember that. This is the thing. When you make yourself travel, you will remember these things forever. They will live as little postcards in your head forever.
That's true. Do you think travel has affected your feminism? Do you think it makes you... I think it makes me question my assumptions.
Tell me more.
Sometimes I go somewhere and think, oh, we don't do it that way. So I might see this as... oh, this is more feminist than anything I grew up with or experienced. Or, oh, this seems less feminist than something I've experienced. But then what about me seems less feminist to them? Mm-hmm. And I think it just going to different paradigms and being a woman and seeing the way women live or the things they talk about or how they engage with the world or have leadership roles or have leadership roles in families or in career-wise or whatever, it always makes me go, your version of feminism and your metric is not, there's nothing neutral about it. There's nothing standard about it.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. So it makes me shift my out of my paradigm.
Where has made you feel like the worst feminist? You can interpret that a few different ways, right? Like, where have you thought, oh, these women are getting it right, and that made you feel like a bad feminist, or something that unearthed a kind of ugly, unfeminist something within you?
That's a really, really good question. I'm going to answer by saying there is one place which is like a measuring stick for myself, for my own feminism and personal growth. Did you ever as a kid, did you have a family member ever measure you on the pantry door or somewhere and then you'd measure yourself every year and
classic,
you could see all the lines going up?
Yes.
Well, I have a place which I think is kind of my, in some ways, my center of the universe. It's a place called Cafe Reggio in Greenwich Village.
Been there, know it very well.
It's right... near Washington Square, there's all these NYU students come in. It's got the oldest cappuccino machine in the whole of America. Like very early Italian immigrants came and set it up. I think the only reason it's still there is they bought the shop, so there's no rent. No one can kick them out.
Okay.
And it has been exactly the same. Like if you look at the pictures, there were beatniks there. Louisa May Alcott lived across the road. I don't know if it was quite there when she was there, but it's so old. And if you look back on any ancient pictures of it, the chairs are the same, the tables are the same, the menus are the same. You know, I'm sure they've updated what's on the menus, but it all looks exactly the same. There's Renaissance paintings in there.
What?
Yeah, probably not by masters, you know, that someone would come in and steal it, but genuinely Renaissance paintings that look like, you know, some ones you'd see in a museum that the family brought over. I used to be there in the 90s when I was still in a quite patriarchal cult. And I used to go there and I used to look at all these NYU students who were talking about philosophy and art and theater and all theater people always come in and they're casting a show or something. And it was full of these arty people who were living their life. And it's what I wanted so desperately. And I felt so shy and like no one would ever fancy me. And I couldn't have a connection with anyone in that world anyway, because I wasn't allowed to. But I'd left Australia and I was living it. I was out. Do you know what I mean? Like I'd made it this far.
Yeah.
It was psychologically then taking that next step to liberate myself from a way of thinking. And it was sort of like a first step, but I would look at everybody else and go, this is where I want to be. I want to be part of this action, this world. Mm-hmm. And then I came back to London. I left a religion and I started to grow. I went to university. I started a theatre company. You know, I did all these things. I try and go back to that cafe every couple of years. Mm-hmm. Don't always make it, you know, but sometimes I get to go every year. When I sit in that cafe now and think about my young self, because the cafe's exactly the same.
Yeah.
I can remember everything.
Uh-huh.
And because I don't go there too often, it's not become wallpaper either.
Mm-hmm.
If I lived there and went there every day, all those memories would go away. I see my young self.
It's your time travel port.
Oh, it is. I'm like, oh, I was here at this exact table, and it's the same table, it's the same chair. The only thing that's different is they don't write the checkout anymore. They do electronic, but that they were decades after everyone else on that. They held on tight for a long time. Everything else is the same. And the young people are the same. They're just different generation of students, but they sound the same. They look the same. You know, there's something about that place that never changes, but I've changed.
Yeah.
And I think, God, if I could have seen myself in the future, and I'm over here doing a show, or I'm over here writing a screenplay, or I'm over here with my theater friends talking about, my comedy friends talking about what we're going to do, or what show we're going to do, or who's directing that. I'm one of them now, and I got there, and I changed, and I became myself. And that is the greatest feminist thing I could imagine. And I look over every time at Louisa May Alcott's house, and I go, so this was going to be funnier and less sad. It's the second time we cried.
Because I think it's about travel, and travel is about, like, it is about literal and non-literal journeys that you go on.
Mm-hmm.
And those are really moving things.
Yeah.
If you're trying to answer these questions honestly, you know, it's really moving that you made her proud.
Yeah. And I made young me proud, and Louisa May Alcott's watched the whole journey every time I come back.
Of course, you couldn't have done it without Louisa May Alcott.
No, she gives me a wave and she says, I see where you are.
I see you now.
You struck out and you changed and you came into your own and you found your power.
Mm-hmm.
And you got out of something that was very patriarchal, and you don't live that way anymore. You realized in this room you didn't have to, because all these other people weren't, and you were brave. And now you're part of it. And it's only because that cafe doesn't change. Like, I'm so scared that one day it will be gone, and then, you know, I won't have that. It's like when your grandmother sells the house and someone else paints over the pantry door, and those measurements for you are gone. And I hope if that ever happens, I hope it doesn't happen. I hope if it does happen, I can keep them in my heart.
Do your parents still live in the house where you grew up?
Oh, no.
No.
No, they moved and built houses, and no. And my hometown used to be very kind of family on the beach type place. And there's been a lot of reconstruction. So when I go back home, it's a bit like, do you know Back to the Future 2, where Marty goes back to Hill Valley and Biff Tannen's taken over the town? So now it's all strip malls and strip clubs.
You might be one of the only people who knows that Biff's last name is Tannen. Keep going.
I'm an aficionado. That's what it's like for me. I go back to the Gold Coast in Australia, and it's like Biff Tannen took over my town. Uh-huh. I don't recognize it. I can't. I know my old school and stuff, but mm-hmm, everything mm-hmm. else is so built up. It's very hard to see what it was and where it was. But I did recently, when I went back, a couple of months ago, I took my mother and sister on a tour of all our old houses, schools, haunts, to go down memory lane. And I tell you this, I just jumped out of the car, knocked on the door of the house that we lived in, that my parents parents built. Like, they weren't rich or anything, but in Australia, people, you know, build, you know, it's sometimes cheaper to buy a piece of land and build on it. It's very common in Australia. They built this beautiful little house on a little hill, like, so it was like a little stilts house. And we all helped as teenagers, like, be like, oh, I want my bedroom to be like, you know, I mean, you have much to say really, but, you know, we remember the blueprints type thing. Remember going to the building site. And I went and knocked on the door, and these people came out, and I said, this is really strange of me, but we used to live here and we built this house. And the lady said, come in. And we went in. It's so much smaller than I remember it.
Right.
We got to see it. And they've done things to it. And they were so generous. And their daughter came home while we were there. She's an architect now. And I get very young. Yeah. She's still living at home. And she said, oh, this house really inspired me to become an architect because it's so different and it's on stilts and it's like, you know, got like little crevices.
So much
and,
personality.
Yeah. Little, you know, little bits and bobs and stuff. And they've remodeled a little. And it was a beautiful thing to travel home with my mum and my sister. My mum's, you know, it was something. It was really something to get to be somewhere we'll probably never be again. Mm. You know, I'm not going to ask them again. They said, oh, come back next time and have dinner or something. And I was like, I can't be knocking on these people's houses and imposing on them, you know, but it was beautiful. What about you? Are your mom and dad still in their house?
They live in the house that I was brought home to when I was a newborn baby.
So oh, I think, my God.
Yeah, yeah. So that's such a – so I'm so defined by that house. My grandmother lived in the same house for 60 years. And died very old. She was 99 years old. And in recent years, like this new family with these three young kids have taken over this house. And it was interesting. It's not that I couldn't process my grandmother dying. I could process it. But she was very, very old. It was a long time coming. It was a strange thing to grieve.
Yeah.
But there was something about when I went to look at her house and I saw these little tricycles out front and a kid run around this thing when it had been my, you know, my entire life's experience had been going and visiting my grandma and sort of like.
You'd been on that tricycle. You'd been running around that house.
Yes. Somewhat recently, you know, and just then watching this older and older woman kind of tottering around inside. And that's when I was sort of able to understand she was gone. Because like, oh, this isn't ours anymore. And I would love to go into that house. I'm just waiting for the, you know.
The right moment.
But I think your story is a lovely one because I think the truth is most people would welcome that knock and think, God, what a lovely, gorgeous thing. And yes, of course, come and remember.
I'm desperate to go to the house I was in when we lived in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 houses or something like that. And there's one in particular that I would love to knock on the door. And there's something about it, the way they've got a fence up that makes me think they wouldn't welcome me. And then I'd feel rejected and sad. But one day I'm going to do it because why not?
You've got an upcoming trip to Australia coming. Maybe this is the one.
Maybe this is the one. Maybe this is the one where I go home.
Home, home.
Yeah.
Home.
Home.
That's the thing travel makes you think, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
What is home, home?
Well, you know what? The first time I flew into London ever, and by the way, I wish I'd gone British Airways, it was like 48 hours.
What?
Oh, kids kept stopping places and refueling.
Oh, okay.
And they'd kick us off the plane and then they'd come back on and then get to kick us off again. So it took so long. I didn't care. I was so excited to be coming to London. Yeah. And even seeing lounges of places, I was like, I'm here. I'm on the ground of this country I never thought I'd go to. I was so excited and so young, I didn't care. But when I flew into London, I had all my childhood. I'd read books about London. And I think part of it was also getting away from the cult. That was the first step of it, even though I was still in it.
Mm-hmm.
But since I could read, I was desperate to live in London and I never knew why. But that's where all the stories were in my books. A lot of children, Australian children, be raised on a lot more Australian books now. But then most of the books I had were set in London or set in England. And so to me, it was like Narnia. It was like, you know, well, now what kids would say Hogwarts, but we didn't have Harry Potter then. It was like you get to go to that place. And I just knew it was my home and I didn't know why. And when I was flying in to land after this, you know, over a working week journey, it was so green. And Australia, because it doesn't get so much rain, it gets a lot of sun, often is very, it's a light green or a brown color. It's beautiful. Mm-hmm. You know, famous Dorothy McKellar poem, I love a sunburnt country. But there was something about the green of it, I recognized it, and I could see you're floating over and you can see the houses and I could see like little old buildings and, you know, like I was like, oh my God, and tears were streaming down my face. I started sobbing and the lady next to me said, are you coming home? And I said, yeah, I think I am.
Oh my God, we're gonna go again.
Oh my God, it's so emotional. Oh my God. And I think there's part of me that still calls Australia home, as the song goes. But my nest now, my people, you know, is London. There's something about me. And do you know what? When I found my biological family, it turned out my great-grandmother I wanted to know why I did comedy, why I did performing, and why I was so desperate to live in London. My great-grandmother, turned out, was a comedian in London. This is my biological great-grandmother. She and her sister, Lucy, were a double act, comedian, vaudeville, musical double act. And then Hetty went solo and became a ballet dancer. Lucy became a solo comedian. And I could see she's booked gigs all around the country. I've seen reviews of hers. I've seen letters from her turning down gigs because she's so booked up. Yes, thank well done, Lucy. Because apparently women were funny before the war. that's true. It's true. It was only television that killed women's careers.
Okay.
Yeah, it was. They were all musical and vaudeville. Over half the bill were women. If you went to musical or vaudeville and it was an all-male bill, people would ask for their money back.
Uh-huh.
So I want to do a documentary about it because I think it's so interesting about what happened in that trajectory. Also, it turned out that my great-grandmother got married and had kids, moved to Australia in those days by steamship because one of her kids had asthma and they were told to move to a hot country or he might die.
Oh, God.
And her eldest daughter, Eulalia, with whom I feel a massive affiliation, missed London so much because she'd been raised in Shoreditch and she saw a train track and she started walking down the train track with her doll and she walked for an hour and a half into the bush because she was thinking this train track must be going somewhere where I can get back to London on her own. She's a little girl. And about an hour and a half later, she realized she was going to die. She didn't go back and she walked all the way back and no one had missed her. No one had noticed she'd gone. And I thought, oh, my God, when I found out the story, I was like, she literally tried to walk back to London. She missed it so much. And I thought, oh, my God, that was it. I was trying to get back to London for Eulalia.
You finished like I felt her walk.
It. Yeah.
You took her walk for her.
Yeah. Crying again. Oh, my God. Okay. Sarah Barron.
Yes, ma'am.
Have you got any travel tips?
Yes, I do. Let me encourage everyone to please, if you have not done this already, please, please, please invest in an orthopedic pillow.
Mm.
And please, I beg you, take that orthopedic pillow with you everywhere. I have this very dated view that we don't want to be checking our luggage. Luggage, famous last words, luggage doesn't get lost anymore.
Mm.
You're going to check your luggage, take the extra time, mm-hmm. bring a few extra outfits, bring the stuff you need, bring your layers, and bring your orthopedic pillow. And your neck and your upper back will thank you. My other tip to you, mm-hmm. if you have a child or if you're going to have a child, do not – there's a window of time when a child is no longer nursing or on a bottle,
mm-hmm.
but they also are not old enough to engage with an iPad.
Mm.
Do not travel in that window. Just don't do it. Nothing is worth seeing if you're going to be on a long-haul flight
mm-hmm.
with a baby who can't either just feed or watch a screen.
Mm.
It's a pretty short window of time. Take it out of your diary.
Mm-hmm.
Put it back in once you can pop them on the screen.
Or, as you said earlier, leave them with someone you trust and take a little mama or papa or parent trip on your own.
With your pillow.
With your glass of wine, with your peanuts, with your movie.
Yes.
That's good for you.
What are your travel tips?
My travel tips are pack an hour before you're meant to be at the airport.
This is very you.
And then on the way out the door, realize you forgot your passport and come back. Like, I am the worst.
I think this traveler. Might even actually be the Deborah Francis White special. It's the DF Dubs super special.
Oh, I have got one. I've got one.
Go
because
on.
Because I'm such a messy traveler.
Uh-huh.
Like, I love traveling. I'm just so unanxious about it. I just think, oh, it'll be fine. Throw a couple of dresses in. And then suddenly at the last minute, I go, oh, you should have extra shoes. I don't know what I do. But I'll tell you something that I learned because of messy traveling.
Uh-huh.
I locked my passport into the hotel safe, went to the airport.
Deborah.
And realized it was in the hotel safe.
I feel sick.
I was very chill about it because the really nice people said, look, we'll put you on the next flight.
Oh.
Go back and get it. It's okay. You're going to be okay. Luckily, I was flying British Airways, and this is not just – I'm not just saying this for the podcast. Do you know what they told me? This
Go
is
on.
A special tip. This is a British Airways tip.
Yes.
This is for all you messy travelers out there. What they said is some of our flight attendants put one shoe into the safe with their passport. When they go to pack, they go, hold on, where's my other red shoe? Or where's my other trainer? It's in the safe. They open it up. Passport's in there. Never forget it.
Genius.
Genius, right? So if you have a couple of pairs of shoes with you and not just one, bung one shoe in. Otherwise, bung in something you're going to notice is missing. That's my travel tip.
Big picture, probably more helpful than my orthopedic pillow one, but I still think it's really good for people's necks.
Really good for people's necks. And get a, you're saying it's a good one, not one of those blow up ones you buy at the airport.
No, no. I'm saying you're packing in a suitcase a full pillow.
Oh.
Because what fun is travel if you're waking up all stiff? You can't just be dealing with a hotel pillow. This is something I've got into as I got older.
My husband would love this tip. He's obsessed with pillows.
I was not ready for this emotional journey that we were going on today.
Thank you for listening to this very special and unexpectedly poignant episode of The Guilty Feminist, brought to you by British Airways. We've obviously spoken about a lot in this episode about travel and how it can shape you as a person. If you also believe in the power of travel, then I have one last piece of advice for you. Fly British Airways. In them, you'll find a kindred spirit who has the exact same mindset when it comes to travel. They're passionate about original journeys that have the power to shape us as people, which influences everything they do. They know travel is about more than getting from A to B. For British Airways, every journey and each passenger is unique. And remember, everywhere we go makes us everything we are. Book your next flight at ba.com. Side of my face. I'm a feminist, but I hate one side of my face. But do you have a favorite side of your face?
Oh yeah, and I've been in the studio before and it's getting my bad side, but it doesn't matter.
It's getting your bad side and my bad side. Let's switch.
You sure?
Yeah. 100%. Right. If that's okay with you. Oh yeah. Why would neither of us have the chocolate side of our face?
Isn't it crazy? Well, we're not gonna eat anymore right now, but I'll just take my script with me and the water.
The Guilty Feminist is provided exclusively from Acast. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.